As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Welcome to the Rocketship Podcast. This is Michael Saka. So today I talked to Elliot Pepper, who's the author of Uncommon Stock. And what I love most about this interview was Elliot scratches an itch, but not by building technology, but by writing a book. And while he had all the same ups and downs as a SaaS company, he went on to become the first author published by Bradfeld's book company, FG Press. So we talked about a bunch of other stuff. He's also an advisor. He's been in tech for a long time. I think you're really going to like this one. Stay tuned.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our awesome sponsors. CodeShip makes continuous delivery simple and easy. Go to codeship.com/rocketship to get 20% off 3 months.
We'd also like to thank Envision App. Envision is by far the best prototyping and collaboration tool on the market. Go to envisionapp.com/rocketship to get the starter plan free for 90 days.
Customer.io is a modern email platform built for startups. Go to customer.io/rocketship to start sending emails that convert.
Well, the easiest way to think about it is like John Grisham for tech. So it's a tech startup thriller novel about a couple of founders who start a company that basically is able to analyze financial data and tease out red flags where there might be money laundering. And so they get pulled into this whole scheme and sort of an entire conspiracy unravels around them. So it's an adventure story that takes place in the startup world.
It's such a great idea. Where did you kind of get inspired to write a thriller novel for tech?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So I've always been a voracious reader. Like when I was a kid, I was always the kid at the library who would like, you know, I could spend 4 hours there just entertaining myself, finding new books. Right. And as I grew up, like when I came out of college and graduate school, I started working in startups. So I joined a startup initially that was really interesting. They were doing waste energy technology. And then I started my own company. And then I got recruited into a venture capital firm as an entrepreneur in residence. And through that experience, was able to sort of like drop into many different startups. The part that I found most interesting is that there's actually so much natural drama in the venture world, right? Like you know this, your listeners know this.
Yeah.
But you know, there's an enormous amount of tension, of big personalities, of like incredible success and terrible failure and betrayal and really interesting human experiences that happen in that world. And I just thought it was such a textured canvas, such like an interesting world to be in. And I had so many friends, like, and all of us were working in it. And what I found so surprising is that there's an enormous library of entrepreneurial nonfiction, right? Like business books, like I built this company and this is what I learned, right?
Right.
I've been working in the industry and this is what I've learned. And like, this is how you can build a company. And that's great. And there's a lot of really good ones and there's a lot of really crappy ones too, right? But like you could fill an entire warehouse with them.
Yeah.
And there just was really so little fiction in the same setting. And I wanted to read that fiction. Like I wanted to be able to sit down and instead of reading a medical thriller or a sci-fi thriller or a legal thriller, right? Like I wanted to sit down and read a startup thriller and I couldn't really find it to read. And once, maybe this is the entrepreneurial mindset, right? Like once I realized I couldn't find it to read and I wanted it, I was like, well, like maybe I'll try my hand at writing this.
Which, right, total entrepreneurial mentality. So what did you expect when you sat down to write this? What were you expecting the reaction to be from the community?
From readers?
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea at all. You know, I mean, again, I was sort of writing it for myself. Maybe that's selfish, but I also was hoping, hey, maybe there's at least one other person out there who would be interested, right?
Sure.
And I've been blown away by the reaction now that it's out. So the book came out this past March.
Okay.
And it debuted in the top 10 in its category. And I was shocked. And we've had a lot of outreach. We've had a lot of, we've had quite good press, which has been really fun. We've had, you know, we have more than like 50 five-star reviews on Amazon, which
wow.
Blows me away. Like but I think the coolest thing has been like personally, as a writer, is that I've been getting like email outreach from readers who like read it and then like, you know, I'm getting a cold email from a complete stranger who, and the whole email is just like, hey, this is what it meant to me, or this is why it's relevant to my business, right?
Which
is
really
interesting. Or people who are totally not involved with sort of the Silicon Valley tech scene at all, who are like, oh, like I had no idea what this tech stuff was about, but it sounds really cool, right?
Yeah.
I've been overwhelmed. I mean, it's been really fun as a writer to be on that roller coaster and sort of like hear what people are thinking about it.
Yeah, and you were published on Brad Feld's new publishing company,
that's right?
Right. What did they do differently, or what
sure.
What was kind of the approach that they took to this? You know, I assume they're innovating on publishing.
So, they are, yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, Brad Feld, for your listeners who may not be familiar with him, he's a really well-known venture capital investor based in Boulder, and his firm is the Foundry Group, and they've backed many. He's one of the most famous sort of tech venture investors. And he has a very well-read blog, and he's written some really good nonfiction books in the startup space, like Venture Deals is when I was working in venture capital, I used that as a reference. Nice. So anyway, Brad was actually, so the history there is sort of interesting and also personal. So Brad was my first reader.
Oh.
So when I started writing the book, I cold emailed him off of his blog, like his email's on his blog. Any of you guys can go out and email him. And I cold emailed him with the first five or six chapters after I'd been just writing it in Word. And I was like, hey, I love your blog. Like, I really respect what you do. And I think you might be into this. Like, do you want to let me know what you think or whatever, right? And he emailed me back a few hours later. I was like, this is awesome. Like, keep it up. Like, I want to read it as you keep going.
Wow. And
for me, like, he's such sort of a, you know, a really respected thought leader in my field. So I was like, that's awesome, right? Like, that was really inspirational and his enthusiasm was contagious. Mm-hmm. And so it was really cool. Like, I kept writing the manuscript. I kept sharing it with him. And, you know, along the way, I had always actually planned on self-publishing. So I don't, again, like, for those of you who aren't necessarily familiar with the business of publishing, there are five really large publishing companies, and they're the ones you've heard of, like Random House, but they also own all of these different imprints that are basically their brands. And the deal is they sort of offer you a crappy deal, especially as a first-time author. Yeah. If you're already really famous, if you're Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, you can demand whatever terms you want, right? Like, in terms of contract and how you partner with them. But if you're a first-time author, you have very little leverage. It can take years to get your book into readers' hands, and you generally keep, on average, 15% of net across the different formats. And they have really draconian contract terms where it's like, you always have to, like, they have right of first refusal on future manuscripts. You know, it's just, it's a bit of a mess. And they don't, like, they don't operate that well either. There are a lot of really good people in those companies, really talented editors and everything like that. But again, for first-time authors, it can be a real nightmare sometimes when you're working with them. And so the alternative is you either publish with an independent publisher or you self-publish. And I've been planning on self-publishing because I've, you know, done enough project management that I was comfortable managing freelancers and investing in book production. Mm-hmm. And so so that was my plan. But when I sent Brad the final, or the first rough draft of the entire book of Uncommon Stock, you know, and I was already ready to press go on self-publishing, he emailed me back and he was like, hey, we're starting a new publishing company. Would you be interested in exploring publishing with us? And so that was like completely out of the blue for me. And it was really, I was like, whoa, like, what is that going to be? Right? Like, yeah, I'm interested. And so we talked. He introduced me to Dane, who's the CEO at FG Press. And I was really excited about what they're doing. Like, some simple examples are they really try to see authors and FG Press as partners rather than as sort of like the David and Goliath relationship.
Yep.
And so, for example, where a normal traditional publisher gives a 15-85 split in favor of the publisher, FG Press gives a 50-50 split on net. So yes, it really is just straight up partnership, right? Like, we're on the same page. We're partners in telling this story. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's been really positive. They're also experimenting with many new things, like both on the sort of nitty gritty of how you do book production and what you're doing in terms of editorial, but also, and the output of that is, like, for example, I finished the manuscript for the sequel to Uncommon Stock at the beginning of September, right? At the end of August, beginning of September. So a month ago. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's going to release, we're going to launch it December 3rd.
Okay.
Meaning that that's September, October, November, right?
Yeah.
A 3-month schedule from the author sending in the manuscript to the book is on the market and, like, readers can read it. And like at a normal publishing house, that could be 1 to 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, like these are just some examples, but, you know, I could give you probably 2 dozen more.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
Well, how do they handle like the printing? Is there an advantage for you to publish with them for that reason? Is there distribution involved in the deal?
So they distribute through all major, so in order to understand book distribution, it helps to just sort of like look at how the business has changed. Mm-hmm. Borders is out of business, Barnes & Noble's doing really badly. Like brick and mortar book distribution has decreased enormous amounts over the past 10 years, right? And online distribution is now how people buy books, not just digital books, not just like on your Kindle. FG Press distributes through all the online retailers and then occasionally through some independent bookstores. Okay. And that is more or less how I wanted it done as an author. Because if you want to be in, say, the airport bookstore or something like that, what most people don't realize is that for most brick and mortar bookstores, the publisher actually pays for the shelf space. Hmm. So you have to pay thousands of dollars to like have your book there. Right. And it's an ROI decision of, do we think we'll sell enough books for it to pay off? Right.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, as like a first time author, I'm interested in building my audience, and I don't want to be paying for, you know, airport shelf space, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like that's not of interest to me. And if you're distributing through independent bookstores, it's always an ad hoc decision, because you basically have to have that conversation with each individual bookstore. So it takes a lot of time. So FG Press starts by having, you know, books distributed through all of the online options, of which there are many.
Okay.
And then you can sort of make game time decisions for the brick and mortar.
Nice. Nice. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your process that you took when sitting down to write this. Did you have like a schedule? Were you working during the day and doing this at night? What did it look like?
So everybody has their own creative process, right? And I've tried to experiment. Like I see myself as right at the beginning of the learning curve. I think that writing is a craft and storytelling is a craft, and it takes time and experience to get those 10,000 hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really become a master. So I'm right at the beginning, and that means that at the beginning, I have the freedom to experiment with different things. So I tried to be super, I guess, for lack of a better word, anal.
Okay.
And like say, okay, I'm going to write from this time to this time every day. And that didn't really work for me. Okay. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to only write when I feel like I'm inspired. And that also didn't work for me. because like I would go too long in between sessions and stuff like that, right? And so so it's been an interesting process learning myself. And I think that all writers or all creatives in that sense or entrepreneurs really have to, the first thing you have to figure out is how you work best, right?
Yeah.
And so here's a fun example. For the second book, which I just finished writing a month ago, I found it really useful to have a deadline.
Okay.
Like for the first book, I didn't have one because I literally just sat down at work, right, and started typing. But for the second book, I did because I said it. I told FG Press, hey, like, I want to have it done by this time so that we can get it out by this time. Right.
Yeah.
And they were like, sounds good. Like, send it to us. Right? So even though it was self-imposed, it was really useful. And it gave me motivation. And I feel like I see a lot of similarities between writing and running. So do you run, like jog or anything like
that? Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It takes a long time to hit your stride.
Right. And like, as you know, like when you go for a run, like sometimes you have a good day and you're like, oh, this feels amazing. I'm like hitting my stride, like I'm getting my runner's high, right? Like it just feels wonderful. And then many other days, it's a slog.
Yeah.
And the difference is that someone who trains often, I think their percentage of good days gets higher. It never gets to be the majority, or it rarely does. But like, you're more likely to have a good day if you're in good running shape, right?
Yeah.
And I found the same was true with writing. Like, I have to go through this slog in order to get to those good days. And if I'm writing a lot, then it makes it better, right? Like, I get into flow. I remember the story more. I don't have to spend as much time rereading what's already happened to make sure I remember everything. And that deadline was very similar to running a race. So if you ever sign up for a half marathon or a marathon or a 10K or something like that, you know that, like, does the race really matter? No, but it gives you something to train for. So it gives you a reason to be out on the trail or whatever with your friends, you know, going for a run. And I think that's sort of like the closest analogy I can think of.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a really great way to look at it. So how long did it take you to write the first book?
9 months and 200 hours.
Wow. Okay.
So the reason why it took 9 months was because me and my wife actually took a sabbatical during that time. And we're doing a bunch of travel where I didn't even have a computer or electricity. So I didn't do any writing. So it actually took more like 4 months on and off writing. And yeah, about 200 hours total. And then the next book, I think, took less time.
Okay.
I wrote it, I probably started it in, like, I think it took calendar time 3 months and maybe even less than 200 hours. Now, I'm talking about like writing time. There's definitely time, like when I'm going on a walk or something and I'm thinking about the story and trying to get engaged with where the characters are in their lives, that isn't being counted there, but that's about right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. When I'm designing, you're always thinking about what your current project is.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. You can't bill for it, but it's going to happen naturally.
Right. Yeah. Only you could.
Right. Shower time. So what it happens after you write? Like, you've got this first draft.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do? Did you send it off to an editor? Are there freelance editors that will give you kind of feedback and correct the grammar? How did you handle revisions?
Yes. So, well, the short answer is yes, I did. And yes, there are.
Okay, good.
So I have a friend who was a developmental executive for screenplays in Hollywood, and I used her as my developmental editor. And there's sort of different layers of editing. So developmental editing is like substantive stuff, like this character is making decisions that don't make sense, or this plot twist, you know, has this fatal flaw, right? Where you might need to make structural dramatic changes to the manuscript. So you start with that.
Okay.
And then once you've sort of nailed down the big problems, then you move on to, you know, sort of like copy editing, which is more like, okay, the character was holding a coffee cup at the beginning of this dialogue, but at the end of this dialogue, the cup disappeared, right? Like, what happened to the cup?
Okay.
Like things like that. So like lower level, scene level things. And then that also progresses into language editing. Like, you're missing a comma. You know, you use this word too often, right? Like, mm-hmm. you need to mix up the structure on this paragraph. So you sort of get progressively grittier. And at the end of the day, right before you're actually going to print, you do what's called proofreading, which is like, you think it's good. You know, you think it's a good manuscript and you're always wrong. And so so then proofreaders are people who are super detail oriented and really good at looking through text and finding errors or formatting issues and little, you know, all the little things that are important because they can get in the way of a reader's experience.
Okay.
And so for the first book, I did like 7 major revisions. And then we did a whole bunch more of just really low level copy stuff.
Very cool. And then do you find that, like, I had an editor proofread my stuff, and I thought I could write, and I realized that I really couldn't after they had gone through. Do you find that is this time easier for you? Are you starting to find more of the mistakes that the detail oriented copywriters are finding?
No.
Okay.
but I have learned something. So okay. It's just not that. So comparing the second book to the first one, the things that I learned, and again, I think I'm at the very beginning of learning this craft. And so the nice thing about being on the beginning of the learning curve is that you feel like you're making progress quickly,
right?
Like, I'm quite plateaued. I'm sure that'll happen. But like one thing that I really, that my editor was incredibly helpful with on the first book and that carried over as a learning point for me into writing the second book was structure and pacing. So it was like on the story level, like, okay, like let's make sure that like we don't have one section of the story that's all about one thing and then like the next section's all about a different thing. You need to really layer them in much more subtly, okay. Right? And then pacing is a little more clear, right? Like if you watch a movie, like sometimes it drives me a little crazy if you watch a comedy and it's really funny in the beginning, and then at the end it turns into just a romance.
Yep.
Right? And it's like, wait a minute, like I'm not laughing anymore. Like, what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And you see that in action movies or intrigue movies sometimes too. It'll be like, it's really boring for the first 45 minutes and then it gets exciting or vice versa. And so pacing is a really big thing in storytelling where, you know, no matter what kind of story you're telling, just to make sure that it remains engaging for the reader. And so those were two of the things that I focused on a lot and that I think, you know, now that I'm in editorial on the second manuscript, before you start editing, you never know, right? It's like I'm just vomiting onto a page when I'm actually writing the rough draft. But now that we're in editing, I can see that there are less major structural changes that are required.
Okay.
And so I learned something.
Nice. Well, Elliot, thank you so much for coming on. This has been incredibly fascinating, kind of the juxtaposition between publishing and tech. So, and I think there's a lot of carryover, even if you're just writing a blog entry or telling your startup story. Like, we should really, we can look at these storytelling techniques and apply them to anything.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, you have a new Medium collection, right?
Yeah. On startup lessons.
Right. And I literally just threw up Storytelling for Startups in your collection.
We'll so link it down at the bottom of the episode.
Oh, perfect. There you go.
So people can go and check it out, and we'll link to Uncommon Stock too. For everyone listening, where can we keep up with you online?
The easiest way is my blog. It's just my name, ElliotPepper.com, ElliotPepper.com. I've got a mailing list there, so I sort of try to give all the fun stuff to the folks on that list, you know, new release updates and some extra content and stuff like that. And then the other easy way is just on Twitter, just at ElliotPepper.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Rocket Ship Podcast. If you enjoyed it, we have tons of other awesome episodes on our website. Check them out, rocketship.fm.
And while you're there, make sure you sign up for our newsletter, where twice monthly we send out actionable advice for entrepreneurs and exclusive links to AMAs with our guests. That's rocketship.fm. Sign up today. Stuck still, colorblind. Never go.